Michael Williams, are you a lawyer?
No.
Well, are you or aren't you?
Well, that's the awesome thing is that according to the law, we are all liars. We are all.
No, hang on. Don't try to put this off on the law. Are you a liar? Have you ever lied?
Yes, I have lied.
Okay. Are you a murderer?
No.
But you just told me you lied.
Yes.
So how can I believe you're not a murderer?
You're so tricky.
So I guess you've broken all the other nine too, huh?
That's what this all means. We've broken all of it.
Webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment that you saw yourself in God and God in you and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Well, welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast. My name is Beres Bartlett, and I'll be your host tonight, coming from the studios of the Gospel Revolution here in Nashville, Tennessee. And here is the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution in Houston, Texas, Mr. Michael Williams.
Good morning, Beres. Or should I say good evening? I just blew our cover. We're recording in the morning.
Okay, I can already see we're going to have quite a night here. So sit down, snuggle in, buckle up, and enjoy the ride while we get Michael to walk us through tonight chapter 10 of his book, One, the Gospel According to Mike.
What's wrong with you?
It's either this show or indigestion. I hope it's indigestion.
Why?
It'll get better in a little while.
How's your week been, Mike?
It's been a good week. I think one of the most interesting things, which I feel that I'm free to share, Richard Mull and his wife, Eva, the two of them never saw eye to eye on the gospel. She was very much involved in church. A lot of discussions that never yielded any agreement during the last 20 years. And after Richard's funeral, we remained in contact with Eva, and then she got the book, and then she got into Richard's car. She decided to drive Richard's car instead of hers, and when she got in the car, this was just right after Richard's passing, and she called me, and she told me, she said, "And you came on."
Oh, is this a setup or what?
Yeah, as knowing Richard, it's like this was deliberate, you know. He did this. So anyway, the book of Romans was in, and Eva begins to listen, and she says, I didn't know what walking in darkness was. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, you read where Jesus said that walking in darkness means you don't know where you're going. She said, I thought walking in darkness was being in sin and being bad and all of this. And she said, it just means you don't know where you're going. Well, that was a watershed moment for Eva. She is now swimming in the grace of God and so excited. On Sunday, I gave her a call. She happened to be in church, actually, and she left the sanctuary and went into the hallway to talk to me. And she's whispering over the phone what they're saying. And she said, they're talking about the Muslims now. And she was explaining to me, they don't understand the new creation. They don't understand the new creation. They've got to understand the new creation. Because by now she's been through the first CD of Hebrews. She went through it for 10 days.
She's a goner. I mean, she's a goner, isn't she?
She is totally a goner. It's unbelievable. So I've told some of my friends, you know, I used to talk to Richard every day. Never once spoke to Eva, except for Eva to pass the phone to Richard. And now, instead of talking to Richard every day, I talk to Eva every day. So the gospel is so powerful, Paris. It's just so amazing. And to hear Eva time after time come to tears for the understanding of the gospel, the excitement. And when she found out that she was the pearl of great price, it just leveled her completely. Piece at a time, and she's describing an experience that is nothing short of the saving of the soul, for sure.
Without using names, somebody on our webpage this year, Friends of Mike Williams in Facebook, also had an aha moment, and I just love hearing what he's writing. He's saying, oh, I can get that. Now, what is it about the gospel that just drops out of fences like that once we get it?
People have heard me speak of the fractal nature of the gospel, and that if you understand one single concept of the gospel, you understand it all. So when someone does get a single concept of the gospel, let's take any single one of them, even the one of the pearl of great price, all you have to do is turn one of those parables to its proper perspective, that this is what this parable is about. It's not about what we were told. Then suddenly, then the whole world opens up.
Now, Mike, there's an old saying that when all you've got's a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When all you have is a judgment perspective, perhaps every parable has to be viewed through that filter.
Oh, I think so. I think exactly right. I think the gospel of peace is the missing ingredient that throws all doctrines askew. If you do not have the foundation of the gospel of peace, if you do not know that all anger, all judgment ended at the cross, that God is not angry, that there is not a single displeasure from God, there is no ability to please or displease God now, all of that wrapped up in it. If that is not there, there is no way. You are exactly right. Once the foundation is wrong, it's all wrong. And it gets more wrong as the building goes up. I mean, you know, a foundation can be off an inch from one side to the other. In fact, it can be off a fraction of an inch, and you won't be able to tell it. But the higher the building goes, the further it leans. But that's why all of these things collapse on themselves, is simply because this reality of the gospel of peace has never been conceived of in Christianity. None of them believe that God is not angry. None of them believe that there is no wrath to come. None of them believe that.
Gospel Revolution. Hey, Mike, I can't see you on the video stream. What are you up to there? Hello? Hello, Mike. Oh, there you are.
I found these pictures in my drawer.
Kate's her birthday this week, buddy.
Is it?
Yes, yes.
Oh.
I'm looking at a picture of Kate Benham on Mike's video.
I miss her so much. Hey, Kate. How are you? My sweetheart. Happy birthday to Kate. Happy birthday to Kate. I did it a week early, so I wouldn't be late.
Everyone's wishing me a happy birthday. I'm not till the 13th, but I know that maybe Facebook's just messing stuff up. And Pat and Pat Zuniga has a birthday this week, too.
Oh, happy birthday, Pat. My goodness. This is just a big old birthday month.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And happy birthday to Barris, Mr. Donald Bartlett.
I am 21 for the 30-somethingth time. It's not bad, mate. Wait till you get to 61. It's not a bad age to be, except for one thing. When I was a kid, I had to get up in the bus and give my seat to the old people, but now I don't get that. So I kind of lost out at both ends, you know. That's the only downside to being older. That and the fact that if I drop something now, when I'm bending down to pick it up, I look around to see if there's anything else I can do while I'm down there, you know.
So this week you passed me up. We were both 60 after I turned 60 in August.
Well, just think of me as your pace car, mate. I just decided I was going to grow old disgracefully, mate. So I'll lead the way, and then as a bonus, you got someone to blame, right? Michael, we got a review on Amazon for your book. Another one. And can I read it out?
Yes, please do.
While I share some common views with the author, that's you, mate, and feel mainstream Christianity has missed the mark on several things, I don't think this book takes into account all New Testament writings. You cannot take some without the other and hold the whole up as meaningful. The Bible should be viewed as truth or not. There are many statements made by both Jesus and Paul that point to judgment, etc. In Romans, Paul talks about the potter and that some vessels are for destruction. His writings make it clear that not all will be saved. I guess we print everything here, don't we?
Well, let me start at this point, the potter and the clay, and some were fitted for destruction and some were fitted for mercy. If you read that entire chapter, I believe it is chapter 9, if I'm going to venture out here, I think it's chapter 9, that there are many of these comparisons, one right after the other. And you have to put them in the time frame in which Paul is giving the comparison. Paul is giving the comparison of the vessels vessels of honor and vessels of dishonor, the vessels of destruction, the vessels of mercy. He is whom he will have mercy, he'll have mercy. And, you know, who he decides to destroy, he'll destroy. But all of these are in the mind of Paul. If you read the context of Romans and of that chapter, are the difference between before the cross and after the cross. The vessels fitted for destruction was, of course, the nation of Israel. And those that were brought into mercy, of course, is that which was after the cross. It's the failure to draw this line in the right place. See, all you have to do is take that line and put it in the middle of humanity, and you've got a mess. Well, you've got religion on your hands. If you take that line away from the cross of the vessels of honor and vessels of dishonor, if you take just that one away and you don't realize that the vessels of dishonor was before the cross, the vessels of honor is, of course, after the cross, if you take that line away and you throw it out into the human race, everywhere it lands, it creates a religion. Everywhere it lands, it creates a religion. Everywhere this line lands, it creates a religion. The vessels of honor and the vessels of dishonor. Then it becomes very subjective as to who are the vessels of honor and who are the vessels of dishonor. And, of course, our doctrines are better, so we are the vessels of honor. And you, of course, you got divorced people in your church, so you are vessels of dishonor. And on and on and on and on. So It's like this whip being thrown out and dividing people from each other. But you see, if this thing stays where Paul put it, and that was the dividing line to be the cross, then this is quite understandable.
Michael, it never ceases to amaze me how easy it is to build a dogma or a doctrine or a belief system based on verses, little snatches of sentences even, that we simply read and take out of context. It's extraordinary. Not just how easy it is, but it's extraordinary how easily we swallow it. Any other thoughts on this Amazon book review, Michael?
The other issue, of course, is the comment that we don't take into account all of the verses of the New Testament. We do take into account all of the verses of the New Testament. I don't leave one of them out of being taken into account, but we take them in account to the Scriptures. Maybe the first time that anyone's ever heard of someone doing such a dastardly thing of holding New Testament writings up to Scripture.
Why didn't I see this before? And you go to the denominational churches and they don't preach it. I never heard it before. And then, you know, you get in there when you hear about this and for yourself and you say, why have I not seen? It's like it's been hidden. It's been hidden. But now it's being opened up to the world. A gospel revelation.
Listen in your office, in your car, or even your neighborhood bar. You can listen family.
Now, Michael, help me understand this, please. God created a race, and the name of that race was Adam. The man we call Adam was the first goer, or the prototype of that race. A new race was created centuries later, and the first goer and the prototype of that race was called Jesus. Have I got that right?
Yes, and that's what this whole issue was about. Was making a new creation in which God and man would be one. And even when he was questioned about it, the Pharisee said to him, says, you make yourself God. He didn't refute them. So yes, this new creation is the most important thing that has ever happened. There is nothing that comes close. There is no parting of the Red Sea. There is no stopping of the sun in the sky. There is not even the very creation of all things that comes close to the power of this new creation. It is the single most relevant event to ever take place on the planet.
For those of you who are wondering what on earth we're talking about, we're talking to Mike Williams tonight about Chapter 10, Identity is the name of the chapter, from his new book, 1, The Gospel According to Mike. And he starts this chapter off with a delightful story about his boyhood when his mum caught him having stolen a piece of bubble gum from the local store. And she took him back and made him realize that you're a Williams, son, and Williams don't steal. It's a good story. In fact, if you were just buying this book for the stories, you would not be throwing your money away. Now, Michael, you make a big claim here. You say, most of us have mistaken the issue of faith to be connected with circumstances, when in fact it is rather an issue of identity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, faith is about belief. Faith is about whether you accept Jesus into your heart. Faith is about whether you're born a Catholic. Faith is about whether you should go to war because the Protestants don't like the Catholics in Northern Ireland. As nearly as I can remember in my whole life, faith had nothing to do with identity. How do you make that connection?
Well, it seems to have started with identity. It started out that way. That was the whole problem with the fall of the first creation, the one that was created in the image of God, was this lack of knowing for sure. The entire prophecy of Isaiah is about a recovered identity. And a lost identity and then a recovered identity. The very focus of chapter 1 is that the ox knows where he goes, the donkey knows where he belongs, but my people don't know who they are. He identifies that a donkey knows where home is, a donkey knows where he belongs, but the human race don't even have a clue who they are. And he was speaking specifically to the nation of Israel at this time because it was God who chose the nation of Israel and chose the Jewish people to demonstrate all of this out for the entire human race so that we would understand something very, very powerful.
Mike, I've got a question here from Barry Laney on Facebook. He said, is faith belief and is belief faith?
Well, it's been a long time, Bear, since I've gone into those terms. When we fall into the whole issue, the powerful word that we need to understand is knowing. The one thing that we know is that man could not believe. As far as believing is concerned, whatever it is, you can put it in any category that you want. You can give it any definition you want. The important thing to understand is that man failed at it completely, according to John chapter 12, according to the prophet Isaiah.
So whatever it was, whatever faith is, man didn't do it very well.
Whatever believing is, man did not do it very well. Whatever faith is, it was a requirement that only God himself could meet. If they are in any way different terms at all, it is not the issue. This is one of those places where getting to the nitty-gritty of what the word means is not the issue. It's getting to the context of how the words are used. And these words are used in context, like we said, the issue of believing, of course, is brought out in the book of John, where at least 90 times the word believe in some form shows up, as compared to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which altogether the word believe in any form shows up only 25 times. So that tells us that if we're going to learn something about believing, we need to look to the book of John. But we need to look to all the book of John. And by the time you get to the chapter 12, which I think it's interesting that the conclusion that nobody believed, nobody could believe, why they couldn't believe. Isaiah prophesied. The Holy Ghost prevented him. He blinded their eyes. He stopped their ears so that they could not see nor understand at all. This was something that was to be done in secret. This was the work of God, which was the mystery that was hidden from ages before, but now is made manifest unto us on this side of the cross. This was a mystery.
Let us now listen to the wisdom of
Barry, thanks for that question. Is belief the same as faith? Just as a sidebar, I want to note that there are two words in the New Testament from which grow most of our misinterpretations, our misunderstandings, and our dogmas and doctrines that divide us and have us shooting each other little Bible grenades from our creedal trenches. The two words are righteousness and faith. Righteousness in the Greek is the word dikaiosune, from which we get the word deacon. This is the same word as we use for justified, justified, and righteous and righteousness. It is precisely the same word. The problem is we use the verb justified, we are justified in God's sight, instead of saying righteousified, because we have no verb in English for righteous. All we've got is a noun and an adjective. That's it. There's no verb. There's no verb like to righteousify. But that's what God does to us. He righteousifies us. We instead take this word justify. It's an entirely forensic word. It comes from our courtrooms. But it doesn't mean anything like righteousified. Righteousified means I'm made righteous. Justified means, well, I might have done the wrong thing, but hey, in the end, I was justified in doing the wrong thing. No, that's not what righteousified means at all. The other word with which we build more denominations than any other word is the word faith, or in the Greek pisteo, or pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S. We don't have a word to describe the act of faithing. We have faith, we have faithfulness, or the faithful, but we have no word to say, I am faithing. We instead use the very weak English word, I'm believing. Believing is nothing like faithing, nothing at all like faithing. The difference between belief and faithing is best told in a story that centers on a fellow called Harry Blondin, who walked on a tightrope across the Niagara Falls from the US to the Canadian side and back again. When he came back, this is back in the 1800s, when he returned to the US side, he said, who believes that I can carry them in this wheelbarrow across the rope? All the hands went up. Then he said, well, who'll jump in the wheelbarrow for me? No one went up with their hands except a 10-year-old kid. And the 10-year-old got in the wheelbarrow and allowed Harry Blondin to wheel him across the other side. That is faithing. Everyone believed, but only that kid faithed. Because faithing, when you take it back to the Old Testament, with words such as Amin, Barach, and so forth, you get this concept of hanging your whole body, future, life, and anything that's of any value to you off something. And as Mike so well points out, there was only one person, only one born human being who ever was capable of throwing their whole life, their future, their everything on another person, and that was Jesus Christ, who faithed in his own Father. Remember, he didn't raise himself from the dead. According to Paul, God raised him from the dead. He went into that Garden of Gethsemane and then later to Calvary with the certain knowledge that everything that was of any value to him depended on somebody else for its success. And that is what he did for us, because he was the only person who could. So to keep it simple, faithing and belief are precisely the same thing in the Greek and nothing like the same thing in the English. We simply have to resort to certain words in the English because we don't have a verb for them. We have no verb for righteousify. We have no verb for faithing. But that's what it is. It's faithing. It's pisteoing. In fact, if you just do a little word study, and you can do it easily in any English Bible software, on the word pisteo or pistis in the Greek, and just see every way that it's been translated, you'll get some really interesting insights. Just want to finish with this. Michael and I were talking during the week about this very subject, and we both want to take this further, and we will in the future. In the meantime, let's go back to Michael, who is about to explain how God used certain things to distract us from his real plan. Hi again, Michael.
I was on the phone with Chris Harrington yesterday, and that can always be a dangerous thing. Chris was explaining to me an already diagnosed mechanic of learning. I have to talk to Chris two times about the one time I talked to him to understand what I talked to him about. And then I really feel smart because it only took me two times to talk about the one time that we talked about this one time to understand what he said. So, but anyway, I got it, but I'm not remembering the terms. But anyway, he was describing this terminology, and he said, it's like if I tell you to put both of your hands out in front of you, palms up, and tell you to only pay attention to your right hand. He said, then if I lay something in your left hand and tell you only pay attention to your right hand, he said, you are not going to be able to keep from seeing what is in your left hand, because if you can't close your hand, you can't feel it, you can't figure out what's in your hand. So eventually you are going to look at your left hand and start trying to figure this out. Oh, well, it's round, it's square, it's whatever, you know, and weighs about this much and blah, blah, blah. Wow, that's nice. I like the color, blah, blah, blah. And then you're not going to be seeing what's going on in the right hand. So here's what I got out of what Chris said to me. I'm not going to blame Chris for this conclusion, but suddenly I realized what he's explaining to me is the mechanics of the mystery of how that God, by his right hand, I realize how many times, you know, everything's done by the right hand of God, the right hand of God, and that over in the left hand, he placed the law, he placed the requirement to believe, he put everything, all of that stuff in the left hand. This is just for a mechanics of learning. It's not a doctrine, okay? Uh-huh. So then he gets the entire world's attention off to the left hand, while on the right hand, he is performing the greatest thing that ever happened on the planet.
Who was it, by the way, that said, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is?
Yeah, I think it was Jesus, yeah.
Now, Michael, why is faith got nothing to do with our circumstances? Surely if my mum is dying, or if you're sick, or if I'm broke, surely faith's got to come into play there. Why would faith not be connected with circumstances?
Jesus was the one who connected faith to circumstances in the most dynamic way, and he showed us what faith could do. Faith can heal the sick, cleanse the leper, raise the dead, cast out devils.
But you need a lot of faith for mountains, right?
Yes.
I mean, a lot of faith. I mean, a huge amount of faith for a mountain, right?
Absolutely. So basically the conclusion,
Michael,
of Jesus.
Mike?
Yes.
Now you're supposed to say, well, if you call a mustard seed a lotta, I'm trying to get you to say, no, he said that was a minimum amount of faith. Sorry, buddy. Keep going, mate.
So the whole issue of faith was Jesus, number one, showing us we didn't have any. Just like you were saying with the mountain. I mean, he was showing us that there's no way, because the smallest amount would be the greatest amount. And, faith would move a mountain. You could say to this mountain, be thou removed and cast into the sea, and it will obey you. Obviously, no one's done that. But the fact of it is that the prophecies of Isaiah, remember, Jesus came to fulfill the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. If all of Isaiah is about identity, and I would challenge anyone to divert from the what Isaiah says he's about to speak about is the issue of identity, then you're going to have to look at it through some lens that is chosen by yourself or your church. But Isaiah said it was his prophecies were about the identity. So when Jesus comes along, what are we supposed to get out of that? Of course, his temptation was all about identity. If you're the Son of God, if you're the Son of God, if you're the Son of God, seems like the very same identity issue is coming up again that came up with the first Adam. Now the last Adam's going through the same thing.
Well, let's just go back to that. You say in this chapter, you say that God said, in the day that you eat from this tree, you'll surely die. And there was a death. You make the point that it obviously wasn't physical death because they didn't die until decades later. But what you say is Adam and Eve's identity died. Now, is this akin to what we hear from many preachers who say we stopped being human beings and started becoming human doings?
Well, actually, that statement came from me, from going from human beings to being human doings. It's quite a story, actually.
That one came from you? You started that rumor?
I coined that term, that we became human doings instead of human beings. That got into one of these major self-help weekend groups, and the leader of that group was blown away with that statement, and it was adapted into that program, and out of that program it spread around the world. So
so is this the identity thing that you're referring to in Adam?
Yes.
So what you're saying is our identity is in who we are, not what we do. Is that what you were saying?
Yes, absolutely. I'd also like to point out that when God said, for in the day that you do, you shall surely die. He talks about the day. Then when we start talking about Jesus, we're talking about the day of the Lord, the single day. For in the day that you do, you shall die. So the human race had to die. Now, the total obliteration of humanity, of Adam, did not happen until the cross. The fulfillment of what God said, for in the day that you do, you shall die, happened at the cross. That was the fulfillment of that completely, because that is when Adam truly died. That is when the human race truly bit the dust, if you will, and that identity was completely destroyed. The identity of being in the image of God was completely obliterated. It died at the cross.
Gospel Revolution.
When you're feeling down or you got the case of the blues, why don't you listen to the Gospel Revolution?
Need a friend? We'll be your friend on Facebook. Look us up under Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Go on, do it now.
Hey, Mike, you seen any good movies, read any good books, had any good revelations lately?
Well, you know, this morning I woke up and, as is my usual thing that I do in the morning, so I just get into habits, you know, waking up every morning. Geez, why can't somebody do something a little different? But
hey, if you die in your sleep, that'll be different.
Yes, absolutely. That'll be the only time I do it different. I guess I should not hope to do it differently, should I? I think the only thing you can do differently is just die in your sleep. But this morning, for some reason, as I woke up, the term came to my mind, and a nation shall be born in one day, which actually it's in a question form. It actually says, shall a nation be born in a day?
Oh, I know this one. I know this one. This is Israel, isn't it?
That is what we are taught. And man, I'm telling you, we went crazy with it back in the 70s, for sure, and the 80s, that this was a very primary verse in our eschatology about the end of the world, and that this was a part of the end of the world, was that a nation would be born in one day. So when I woke up, I just thought, there's something wrong with that. And I don't know why it was on my mind. I thought, first thing I need to do is boot up my computer and go to my Bible program and check and see. I want to know what those words mean, because I want to read that in context, because there's something wrong with this. That's just because, number one, I know that everything was fulfilled at the cross, so this cannot possibly have been what we were taught, a verse about the birth of the nation of Israel in 1948. So I get my little Bible program up and, of course, pull up my interlinear, and I begin to look at it in the Strong's exhaustive concordance. And there it was. I mean, the term nation is the same term. It's the term that's used all the time throughout the Old Testament to talk about the Gentiles, to talk about the heathen nation. It's used that way, and it's known that way in every other place. And sure enough, there it was. He's talking about a Gentile nation being born in a moment. So again, we're not talking about something that happened in 1948. We're talking about something that happened 2010 years ago. A nation was born in a day. The time of the Gentiles was fulfilled. The time of the Gentiles had come.
And didn't he say in the scriptures, didn't he say, I'll give you the heathen, God talking to his son, I'll give you the heathen for your inheritance? That would kind of gel, wouldn't it?
And that also, that the point of the heathen being an inheritance for Jesus himself, that he would inherit the Gentiles.
Who wants to inherit a heathen?
Take a lot of love. Take a lot of love. It's like seeing an old dog along the road and said, who could love that thing, you know?
I mean, wouldn't that be a bit like in modern terms, you wake up one morning and you get a letter from the lawyer, and the lawyer says, hey, your uncle died, and you've just inherited a couple of prostitutes, a pervert or three, a politician, and a used car salesman. Wouldn't it be sort of like that?
Well, kind of, if it wasn't that drunk was your son, that old drunk, that old prostitute was your daughter, you know, because that truly is what this was. These were already God's people. And this was not him claiming something that was never his. He was claiming what was always his.
Gospel Revolution.
I'm reading from chapter 10, the chapter entitled Identity, from Michael Williams' new book 1, The Gospel According to Mike. And I'm reading a paragraph that goes like this. The requirement for faith seems to be focused on the human race all the way through, but the fulfillment of faith, this is comparing the fulfillment of faith to the requirement for faith, but the fulfillment of faith, like every spiritual fulfillment, falls at the feet of Jesus himself, because as it turns out, the rest of the human race just couldn't believe in Jesus. But I believed in Jesus, mate. You believed in Jesus. We all believed in Jesus. I mean, you've got to be some kind of idiot not to believe that there was a fella called Jesus.
Yes. And there again, to the point that believing in Jesus was not what was going to help us. This was the red herring, if you will. The law was the red herring. None of this was set up to be the real thing. The temple was the red herring.
You're saying all of this stuff was the stuff in the left hand?
Yeah, absolutely. If we stick with Chris Harrington, speaking of red herrings.
Oh, you're a sad sausage, you are.
That was bad, wasn't it? But anyway, this was the Red Harrington. But anyway, sticking with that, yes, this was the diversion, the law and the requirement to believe, while on the other hand, God himself is performing the most amazing thing for the human race.
You wrote, when you were talking about the temptations of Jesus being all about identity, you wrote, what the devil did do was to try to use the circumstances to destroy the identity. Do you think that happens to us today?
Yes, and I have to ask the question, where does the challenge to our identity come from? Where does the challenge that we are one with God come from? Where does the challenge that we are holy and righteous and perfect come from? Where does that come from? It comes from the pulpits of Christian churches and all other religions around the planet to some degree. It doesn't come from the bar. It doesn't come from the prostitute on the street corner. It comes from church. Now, whether or not you or I or anyone else believes that this is where, quote, temptation is coming from now, or that we were ever forewarned about this temptation or not, the fact of it is, I do know the place where the challenge to our identity comes from on a regular basis, and that is from all religions that I know of.
You wrote in this chapter, the most powerful thing that can ever happen to a human being is to believe in themselves. This is true whether a person is an atheist or any kind of believer at all. Now, I was taught that that was humanism.
Yes, it is. We've had to take everything as Christians, we've had to take everything that seems to work and put a negative term on it. And yet every Christian practices humanism. Every Christian that's ever gotten an education is practicing humanism. Every Christian who's ever gotten a job and tried to get a better job is practicing humanism. Everyone who's tried to be a better person is practicing humanism. So, you know, you can call it humanism, you know, and these terms, of course, are drawn in the sand. These lines are drawn in the sand with this terminology, with the intent to divide, because we believe we're divided already, so we have to just come up with other places to draw the line to explain where we're divided.
Modern Christianity has over 30,000 splinter groups that we know of. Do you think that's an indication that we worship at the altar of us and them?
Well, I don't know if I would use the term worship, but we certainly abide by the religion of us and them. It is certainly the doctrine of the day in any denomination that you want to walk into. It is to some greater degree and some lesser degree, but there is none that it is not to some degree.
Why is the best thing a human can do be to believe in themselves?
Because the only way that you can ever really say you are a believer in Jesus is to believe in yourself.
Why?
The only one who really believed in Jesus when he went to the cross was Jesus. So Jesus said he endured these things for the joy that was set before him because he believed in himself. He believed he was the Son of God. He passed that test, remember, when he was tempted to do something magnificently wonderful, not terribly bad, but to do something magnificently wonderful here on this mountain after 40 days of fasting. Do something magnificently wonderful to prove that you're the Son of God. And he resisted that temptation. But I think it goes to a deeper issue than that, Barris. I think it comes down to knowing. Paul was not content with being a believer. Paul was not content with having faith. Paul said that he wanted to know Christ. not believe in him, but to know him and to know the power of his resurrection. Now, what can take us from the issue of believing and trying to have faith to knowing? What could cause me to know Christ? Not believe in him, but know him. Well, the only thing I can tell you is Paul's prescription for it. And Paul said that he gave up all of his own righteousness that he might know him and the power of his resurrection.
I'm reading again from this chapter, Michael. One of our greatest needs as humans is to be able to accept God's verdict about us, even as Jesus accepted God's verdict about him. Before Jesus did any mighty works, he heard this coming from the Father. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. What I'm hearing you say here almost is that God nurtured his Son in affirmations as to who he was.
Yes, he did. And I think that that is our job with each other, is to nurture one another with these affirmations. And if you noticed, Gospel According to Richard, the one thing you heard from Richard all the time is, you're righteous, you're holy, you're perfect, you're without fault, you're without blame in the eyes of God. And there's people in the Gospel Revolution, that's what they say on their answering machines. It's not that whether we live or die, it's not whether or not that we could get healed or not get healed, or prosper financially or not prosper financially. The issue is identity. Once this planet receives a transformation of identity, what is that going to do? Number one, it is going to place us in a mindset of a new creation. If you have a mindset of a new creation, you're going to know you're not living on a terminal planet. This terminal mentality is killing us in every way. When you believe something is inevitable, this is a mental and emotional state that can be proven psychologically. When someone begins to know that something inevitably wrong and bad is about to happen, the brain has a tendency to say, well, let's just go ahead and get it over with. Let's just go ahead and do it. So you see, by the fact, if you believe that the end of the world is upon us, if you believe Armageddon is coming, you see, the very first thing that happens in the psyche of the human being is, well, let's go ahead and get it over with. Because when we face something dreaded, we want to do what? We want to get it over with. We don't, okay, if it's going to happen, let's do it. All right, okay, come on already. Hey, you going to kill me now? You know, if you're going to, let's do it now. Don't wait till later. Do it now. So this is what a terminal mentality does to the human race. It literally causes us to begin to fulfill these prophecies. Now, it has happened time and time and time again that we begin to fulfill. And why would we want to try to fulfill them? For prophecy's sake? No, simply because the human race, in the way we think, when we see that something is inevitably bad going to happen, we say, get it on. Let's get it over.
So the Mayan calendar says that we're all going to die in the end of 2012. So what do you want to say to the people out there, Michael, who think that this year, 2012, could be the end of the world? Say, I don't know, December 31st.
Well, of course, if you think that this is all going to end on December the 31st, let me tell you what you can do. You can have everything signed over to Mike Williams Ministries, only Illinois, for the very next day. So make sure that on the 1st that all of your assets are transferred to Mike Williams Ministries, because you're not going to need them.
Michael, you say in this chapter people are constantly extolling the virtues of believing and having faith, and then billions of dollars are spent trying to get people to do this. But you pose the question, well, how do you do it? And, of course, it depends on which one of the 30,000 denominations of Protestantism you belong to. But how do you express your belief? Do you bow down many times a day? Do you start speaking Christianese? And if so, what dialect? Do you attend a church? Do you join the choir? Should you confess your sin? I mean, How are you supposed to use this? I mean, this faith thing, the only thing I know is apparently it can help me not die. But I didn't even, I mean, the first person I ever prayed for out of seminary, he died.
Shocking, isn't it?
So how are you supposed to use it? Well, it was a bit of a put down on me, you know, I thought it was pretty good.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, what are you supposed to do if you truly believe? The second church that I pastored, I took over that pastorate from a pastor who had died. Now, this was one of the original Word of Faith churches in Southern Illinois, and Jerry Seville and all of these Word of Faith people had come through there strolling through as Word of Faith teachers, and this church sprang out of that. So there was not a root of denominationalism in this church at all. It totally came out of the Word of Faith movement. It was taught by the Word of Faith movement. And the reason that I am being brought in as pastor some years later is because the pastor died of a massive heart attack. Now, when you talk about what are you going to do if you believe, let me tell you what you do if you really believe. You refuse to allow your pastor to be buried, and you send round-the-clock prayer vigils into the funeral home, and you make every attempt to raise him from the dead for 3 days, refusing to allow him to be embalmed. So that's what you do if you believe. You raise people from the dead. When you fail, you still don't fail. You go to the graveyard then. At what point do we finally realize this stuff don't work, Barris?
Okay, I'm a good Methodist. We don't believe in raising the dead. How do I get addicted to faith? What faith do I practice? How do I make faith work for me? Or if I'm a Presbyterian, or if I'm a Baptist?
Well, of course, in most of those denominations, the practice of their faith really comes down to morality. It is a moral call. So if you are a person of faith, you don't do this, you don't do that. Now, it depends on which church, Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterian, that you go to as to which rules are applicable and which are not. You go to some churches and smoking is strictly prohibited. You go to some churches and between church and Sunday school, all of the elders are out on the front lawn smoking before they go back in for church. So it really all depends, but most of the expression of belief for most churches falls onto the grounds of the evaluation of morality.
You describe the gospel as stealthy.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Of course, we've come to understand the term stealth to mean operating without detection. It's where we talk about our stealth bombers and things like this, our stealth aircraft. Now, at least that's where I begin to understand the term stealth. And it is true, as we hear the gospel, it does its own work in the mind. The mind is the singular recipient of the power of God now. I could not emphasize this more. Everything that the power of God now needs to do, it is needed in the mind of man.
Now, the single recipient's my mind, not the dead pastor.
Yes, obviously the dead pastor didn't receive.
Not my moral works.
I don't think it's that either. I think that kind of fails along the way also.
Not my health.
That also seems to fail. Raised him from the dead, he's going to die again.
Surely my prosperity, though.
Well, I hope not, because it's only the guys at the top of the food chain that seem to be able to boast that prosperity.
But surely, what about my next job? Surely it's God's will that I have a good job. Or what about the woman I'm going to marry? Surely the gospel has an effect on that.
The only way that the gospel would have an effect on that is to let you know it's your choice, that the one thing you better not do is spiritualize this and let some woman or some man come up to you and tell you that God spoke to them and said that it was his will that you're supposed to marry them, which I know people that happened to. It's been devastating. This line of thinking, let me just say it right out. The practice of this type of faith for external circumstances is humiliating because you put everything you have on the line to say what you believe, and then it don't work.
Which would in turn make it debilitating.
Yes, and that's what causes those things then to become mentally and emotionally disabling. We don't even know what to do. We're mad at God, but you can't say you're mad at God, because if you say you're mad at God, then God's going to do something about that also. So you have to pretend to love God. Yes, I love God. Do you love God? Yes, I love God. So therefore, you go to church. You do whatever.
So the stealthiness of the gospel is not going to creep up and get me a job, get me a wife, get me healed, do anything about my mother-in-law's carbuncles. It's only going to creep up and deal with my mind?
Just mind. Oh, my gosh. Barris. See, before we can allow the gospel to do its work, first off, we have to know what it is. Secondly, we have to know what it's for. It's not to get you healed. It's not to make you prosperous. Although it can have an indirect effect on all of these things, because if the mind becomes healthy, there's many areas of your life that could become healthy as a result of a healthy mind. But the issue is the healthy mind. The issue is the renewing of the mind. What is the renewing of the mind? Oh, now I don't think dirty thoughts. Now I don't think about sex. Now I don't think about making money. Now I don't think about all of these fleshly things. That's not a renewed mind. A renewed mind does not take those things into account as evaluation of spirituality. That's what a renewed mind is. A renewed mind is not that you never think about sex. A renewed mind is to know that the thoughts of sex have nothing to do with spirituality. That is a renewed mind.
In my past religious life, you write, I spent most of my waking hours trying to get rid of my flaws. But I can now tell you that the only way you'll ever deal with your flaws is to embrace them. It will never be by trying to eliminate them. You are who you are. You are what you are, and that has to be reconciled with who God says you are, and it can, in italics, be done. You don't do it by starting to try to become what God says you are. You already are what God says you are. But surely, Michael, I'm a rude individual, and I do mean and nasty things. I'm to embrace that?
Yes, because the first step to being able to have any progress in life is to accept where you are. You can't move someplace else until you know where you are. My problem with dealing with things in my life do not stem from the fact that I know about them. They stem from the fact that I refuse to accept them. I refuse to embrace the fact that, you know, I remember when I found out I was a liar. I was a liar. I remember it was just as clear in my mind as it could be. And I fabricated things. I remember when I was in my teens, I had fabricated so many stories, I didn't know which ones were real and which ones weren't. I honestly lost track of which things actually happened. I had so embellished so many stories, and I realized I was a liar. So, and this was back right after, this was in 1974. I'll tell you exact year it was, 1974. So the thing I did was accept the fact, I'm a liar. I'm a liar. I'm not going to justify this anymore. I am a liar. So who's going to hold me accountable for that? The only one who is going to hold me accountable is me. There is no way that I can surrender accountability to someone else. So I decided, how can I face this? How can I break this habit of lying? So I decided the next time I lie, I'm going to stop in my tracks and say, wait, I'm sorry, I'm lying. Now, that's a big order, number one, to put that requirement on myself. But when the time came, I remember I was talking to one of the guys, And I was just spinning this story I had told so many times, and it was one of them that I finally realized this really is not true. And so as I was talking, I stopped in mid-sentence, and I thought, well, here is the day of reckoning. So I stopped in the middle of my story, and I said, you know what? I said, listen, I have to apologize to you, but I'm lying.
What look passed across his face?
A look I'd never seen before, because I'm sure you never had somebody stop in mid-sentence and say, I'm lying.
How did you feel?
I felt humiliated at first, but I tell you what, Barris, once I got the words out of my mouth, I felt empowered. I felt empowered. It really was an amazing experience just to deal with honesty. I embraced the fact that I was a liar, but then I didn't just embrace it. I decided I don't want to be a liar. So if I'm not going to be a liar, I'm going to hold myself accountable for being a liar.
So holding yourself accountable for being a liar, facing up to the fact that you're a liar, and claiming this dubious distinction that we all share publicly, worked in your favor. Is that what you're saying?
It worked in my favor. Those stories dropped off. I tell you, truth-telling became a cherished thing for me. Our hope is in something that has already happened, and that is that regardless of what we have kept or not kept, done or not done, we are a new creation. We are incorruptible. This mortal has put on immortality. I want to shout this around the planet. This corruption has put on incorruptibility. Nobody believes that, Barris. Nobody believes that this mortal has put on immortality and this corruptible has put on incorruption. They're still waiting on this to happen. And if it hasn't already happened, at what point would it happen?
Hang on. I cannot be corrupted.
You cannot be corrupted. It is impossible. When you became a new creation in Christ, you could no longer sin. It was impossible. The first Adam was corrupted. The new creation cannot be corrupted. It is virtually impossible. Regardless of what anyone on this planet does or does not do, no matter how many Hitlers, no matter how many popes we have, there is nothing that can corrupt the human race ever again in relationship with God.
Michael Williams, if what you're saying is true, that is thigh-slapping, chandelier-swinging, hallelujah-shouting good stuff.
It is the good news. We are incorruptible. My God, we're incorruptible. My God, we are immortal. This mortal has put on immortality. This corruptible has put on incorruption. And we do that again out of Paul's teaching without reading the full context. And he tells us that this has already happened. And he says that it happened at the sound of the last trump. And he says that it happened when death was swallowed up in victory at the cross. We cannot take that out of its context.
Just near the end of this chapter, you write, "For God's opinion of you was formed in Christ and in Christ alone."
Yes, absolutely, Barris. I think the most powerful thing that we'll ever learn is that it is not my opinion about God, but His about me that is powerful in this life.
Say that again, Mike.
It is not my opinion about God that is powerful. It is God's opinion of me. Here, man is trying to use faith to get a response from God, and God used faith to get a response from man.
And say that again, too, please, Michael.
Turned it all upside down. That's where we misapplied faith. We're trying to use faith to get a response from God, and God used faith to get a response from us. And His faith was made full, and now all we can do is respond to that faith and respond to His work and what has been created by His faith. So I am convinced, as Pat, I think it was, that said in your interview with her up in Coleman, Alabama, that I don't think any of us know anything about God. Everything we believe about God is probably wrong. I agree with her, because the power and the understanding and the education that we need is not what we need to know about God. We need to understand what God knows about us. How could we possibly ever know anything about God? At what border do you draw? At what point do you contain God? But we can understand what God thinks about us, and that is the value of the gospel. It is knowing God's view and opinion of us, not learning a view and opinion of God. So the understanding we gain is that faith was never designed for us to get a response out of God. Faith was designed for God to get a response out of us. And of course, that response that God gets from us is simply the filtration of the gospel into the mind of the human race. And that's all. It is not that I'm attempting to not be a liar, or I'm attempting to not be anything, or to be anything. It is simply to allow the power of God now to do its work in the human race by filtering through the brain. Let's let the gospel filter through the brain and teach us how to think in its consistent, persistent, repetitive nature.
The CPR of the gospel.
The CPR.
Sounds stealthy to me, mate.
You're so crazy.
And it is, folks, that we must leave you, and it all comes to an end far too soon for our liking. But we want to tell you that we had a lot of fun making this PowerCast tonight. And so it's good night from me in Nashville, Tennessee, at the studios of the Gospel Revolution.
And it's goodbye from me, Michael Williams, here in Houston, Texas. We love you guys. Appreciate you so much, so very, very much.
We also need you to keep in mind our upcoming conferences in Janesville and in Marshfield, Wisconsin. You're going to have some surprise people up there, and that's all I can say. I mean, isn't it always a surprise to see Mike in town? Make sure you get down to the webpage, www.gospelrevolution.com. Check who to get in touch with. And also next week, I'm going to ask a special favor. I'll be putting a request out on Facebook for people to give me questions to ask Mike next week when we interview him about chapter 11 of his book 1. So what it'll mean is you'll need to be reading chapter 11 and farm in your questions to me so that I can make sure that I hand them off to Mike. And you'll hear the answers to your questions next week from that chapter. We have another great feature also just available for you, our gospel revolutionaries around the planet. If you were to ring USA, you can contact us on 615-649-4488. That's 615-649-4488 in North America. And you can leave questions, you can leave messages, and we'll play them on the air. So make sure and get your voice on the air. Also, you're listening to the laid-back sounds of Jay's Jazz from the Zuniga Project on Reverb Nation. Go there and check their music out. They've got some hot stuff. Also, while you're on the web, go and get some music from katevenom.org. In the meantime, we love you all, and we'll see you same time, same channel next week, where we'll do it just a little bit better. Okay, anything else?
No.
Okay.
I think that's it.
All right. Can't think of anything, buddy. Thank you very much. Hey, listen, can you look,
all right, buddy.
Can you look right at the screen at me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I thought you were looking at me for most of the time, but Yeah, that to me is looking at me. Oh, I see. You're looking at the camera. Yeah, okay.
I keep looking at the camera.
It doesn't matter. It's okay.
Because me looking at me is the most important thing.
I got a buddy, and he says, I don't care how changed I am by the gospel. He says, I'm still the first person I look for in every photograph. All right, friend.
All right.
Thanks so much, Mike. Bye-bye, mate. Love you.